Junkions, welcome to a special thing episode. Let's call it it's a special episode. Hey, it's like those special episodes, a very special episode from the 80s.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about drug addiction.
Yeah.
Maybe some sexual assault.
Scott Baio might show up.
It's going to be a thing. Look, just don't hang out with the bicycle man. Eve Bunker's had a day. I'm arrested, Dad. So you'll notice that you are not hearing the sultry voices of Brian Salisbury and C. Robert Cargill. Instead, you're hearing the manic voices, the manic Friday morning voices of your friendly neighborhood editor, Merrill Barr, and the one and only Joe Carnahan.
Thank you, dude.
How you doing?
I'm good, brother. How are you?
We're good.
We're sitting out on this blazing Burbank morning.
Oh, God.
Getting fried.
We went to one place, and it was a madhouse.
It was a madhouse.
I'd never been there before.
I picked it. I know, bro. I thought we'd have more. It would be a little less crowd. When you see the sidewalk jammed in front of a place, they keep driving.
Yeah.
In LA, forget it.
The place I've been to, I'm not going to say the name because I don't want to slag them, but I've never been here for breakfast. I'm hoping the breakfast is good. We just ordered our food, so the food's going to be arriving in true
junk. So, yeah, it's going to be really interesting to listen to this between mouthfuls of eggs and turkey.
What has happened, though, is I've come here for a late night dinner or a late night snack. And the thing is that this place doesn't do the late night well.
Right.
So.
But it doesn't have to.
It doesn't have
to. Because it knows that you're drunk and it doesn't really
care.
So
it's like if you get the ham wrap, the ham's out of a can. You get the veggie soup, veggies out of a can.
Bro, when you're wandering in those hours, dude, they could deep fry pocket lint and you'd be like, oh, great, man, this is delicious.
But the thing that became a thing with one of my friends and me, and apparently it started with him and another friend of his, was this is where you came if shit went south.
Right.
Like particularly for a comic, it'd be like if you went on stage and then you bombed.
You came here to balm your
you deserve.
Yeah, yeah. Balm your wounds.
Okay, why are we here? We're here because let's start first by saying a year ago you released the best movie Netflix put out last year.
Thank you, dude.
Wheel Man was
I agree.
Amazing. I saw it. I got
a shit ton better than Bright.
I saw them both in the theater. I saw yours twice in the theater, which was nice.
Right.
And I saw Bright in a theater, and yours plays way better. Surprisingly, even though you wouldn't imagine this, somehow yours plays better in a theater than Bright.
It's meant to be. You know, it's funny because we're going to go up to the Napa Film Festival later on. Actually, not this month. I'm sorry, in November. And Mark Lorimer, who runs the festival up there with his wife Brenda, and it's a fantastic festival. But I said to him, we talked about it, and I said, you got to see if you see Wheel Man in theater, it's a very, very different experience. I mean. You know,
the Crash plays in such a different way.
Oh, dude, and Kevin O'Connell, who won an Oscar for Hacksaw Ridge, mixed that film. So, you know, it's like, you know, we're what are we right now? We have Craig Mann mixed El Chicano, won an Oscar for Whiplash. He's about to mix Point Break.
I keep doing it too.
Huh?
How many times is that?
Just change the slates to Point Break the whole time.
We'll get to it. Trust me, Drunkians.
Craig's gonna also do Boss Level. So
okay.
So anyway, but watching that movie in a theater is quite an experience. And listen, I think it's also a lot better than Baby Driver. I'm sorry. It's a lot better than Baby Driver.
I love Baby Driver.
Baby Driver is a fantasy about a boy. Wheelman's like a drama about a man. You know, that's the difference for me.
But you know what? I like Baby Driver, but Baby Driver is
I love
it's
Edgar.
Escapism.
He's a hell of a filmmaker, and it's a lot of fun. It's just is very like I would hear comparisons.
But the thing is, Wheelman is Brian likes to say Wheelman.
Wheelman. We always call him. We just called Frank's character John J. Wheelman. That was his name. His name was John J. Wheelman.
But what's fascinating about Wheelman was it's the script everyone begged all producers beg for in this town, right? It's one location.
Yep.
Super small.
Yeah.
We can do it on $5 million. Like we can find $5 million.
Sure.
Like super easy. But you watch and you go. Somehow, even though this was designed for a small screen, it plays so big.
But you know what's funny? We really didn't. We shot it for a movie screen. I mean, we shot it for the movies. And again, that's the great thing about it. We take the DCP anywhere in the world and show that movie theatrically, which is great. I mean, it's awesome. And it's I think having that the ability to kind of be able to do that and kind of just, you know, if you want to throw it up at the arrow, you want to throw it up. It's not like you're lugging around film cans anymore. You've got a little hard drive.
It's the movie that made me sad Netflix doesn't do limited runs theatrically for their movies.
I think that will change.
That will change. I mean, because Amazon's about to buy a movie theater. Like it's gonna
change. Also listen, Netflix is just valued as the
biggest company,
the biggest entertainment company
ahead
in the world.
Disney.
Ahead of Disney, which is insane. But also Netflix from, you know, Ian Brick and Scott Stuber and the guys that they have over there that we work with that are just remarkable people. They really love movies, man. They're not, these guys are not like kind of the typical like bean counting, like, you know, it's again the difference between the movie business and the money business.
Also the model's completely different. They have the luxury of not needing to nickel and dime. And how are we going to market it?
Right.
We're going to put the trailer on the Netflix YouTube account. That's how we're going to market
it. And let me tell you something. We went there for the run up, and we had done it on Wheelman, and I was out of town. And I did it on Point Blank. You go in and you meet the head of every department, and they spend about an hour and a half, 2 hours taking you through exactly how they're going to do everything. And I thought, my God, if studios, contemporary studios, ran this efficiently, they would never lose a dime because everything is accounted for. This is exactly how we're going to do it. Here's the blueprint. Here's how we're going to market it. There's our head of marketing. There's our licensing person. There's our music person. There's our VFX person. It's incredible, man. Yeah. You sit in this great. It was the Star Trek room, and it's like it's kind of the circular kind of Grecian kind of theater. It's awesome, and they take you through everything, and it's like I love working with those guys. I mean, Fight World comes out October 12th on Netflix. That's the docuseries we did for them, and it's been nothing if not an incredible kind of working relationship and mutually beneficial for War Party and obviously for Netflix, and they want to continue to do business with us, and I'm hoping that when they do this theatrical, because it makes sense to do it. So like movies like Okju can show up on a, you know, I wanted to see that in the theater. I wanted to see that, you know, I want to see Wheelman. Same thing. I mean, obviously you got to see it. I got to see it in a theater, but to have that experience with an audience would have been something else.
Yeah. So, and then you mentioned War Party.
Yeah.
That's where we're here because of you. You said, fuck it. I'm starting a production company. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I just, you know, and I don't listen, if I can help it, I don't ever want to work for a studio again. I, you know, there's no A-Team sequels. There's no Bad Boys. There's no none of that in my life anymore. I just, it's not.
I hear this is opening on James Bond, though.
Never in a billion years. If Idris Elba played Bond, I'd be interested. Nothing against Daniel Craig, but I think it's like that, you know, it's, you know, listen.
You don't think, here's
just
the thing.
You know, Danny Boyle just left. Danny Boyle would have knocked the shit out of a Bond film.
My concern with Idris is literally a matter of, is he too old now to play that character?
No. Black don't crack, baby. And that guy, you think that guy's handsome on screen. You see him in real life. I mean, he's like, that guy's the panty dropper. I mean, you know, I'm as straight as they come. And I'm like, that guy's really handsome.
Right.
No, he's an amazing guy. And he's funny. And anybody that's never seen Luther.
Right.
Especially the first two seasons of Luther. I think it's 10 episodes total. What? He's just brilliant.
Well, Brian Cargill talked about this, where an actor reaches a point in their career, usually around there, 50, 60,
yeah,
where they decide I'm going to do the grizzled motherfucker beaten guys, right? So for Liam, it was Taken.
Yeah.
For Keanu, it was John Wick.
Right.
For Denzel, it was The Equalizer.
Right.
So it's like, yeah, I'll take it.
Yeah. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Like I said, we are in a restaurant.
Yes, we are. Here comes the chow.
Here comes the food.
Look at that.
Thank you
so much. Oh, that looks great.
What'd you order, Joe?
I got the turkey sausage thing with over easy eggs. You hear me banging around silverware here.
And I got the Belgian waffle.
Looks totally low fat and great.
anyway, it would be interesting. The one thing I would find very interesting if Idris was Bond is that idea of, did they not give me a fork?
They did not. Grab one off the table, can you?
Yeah.
I'm gonna entertain the troops while you're gone.
Okay, I'll be right back.
As Meryl, yeah, maybe exactly. As Meryl sashays into the restaurant here to pick up a fork. I think Idris Elba would be an amazing Bond. I think I also think changing it up in terms of diversity and mixing it up is a good thing. And for something like that's been around for, you know, 50 plus years, it ain't bad. Look, he just beat you to it right there, dude. There's your fork. There's your fork, pal. I was just saying, I think from a diversity standpoint, honestly, dude, having somebody like Idris is a boon. It's great.
But what I find interesting is that, as I was saying, like these actors reach this point where they're going to go do their big, I'm going to go beat some people. Like Jennifer Garner's about to do it with Peppermint. So it's like, what if Idris's version of that is Bond? Instead of it being like,
brother, you could probably pitch that and sell it. That's a great idea. No, it's like, you know, what about Bond's kind of reprobate and kind of a drunk and a you know, it's like, listen, that was one of my things. It's like, I never thought they leaned, you know, when I was a kid reading Iron Man in the late 70s, Tony Stark was a pig, man. He was a drunk and just like always at the edge of this moral crisis. Like, it's not really me, it's the suit. I don't really have any real power. And when Rhodey took over and was like Iron Man for a while, when he was just like on a bender, it's like, you know, I always loved that real.
Is that the demon in a bottle run?
I think so, dude. This is the late 70s, brother, so I'm not sure what exactly that I wish I was more steeped in exactly what, you know, but I just remember like just being wowed by that, you know, and thinking like, man, they really leaned into it. And they did a little bit, but they didn't go kind of, you know, really down the line with what that might have been and what that would have looked like. And I think, God, to do that with Bond would be is a great idea.
Yeah.
It really is.
So, anyway, so War Party.
Yeah.
So, what was it? So you want to be at the... So you start a production company, and it seems like you're trying as hard as possible to keep it... Whenever, like, no one else. If it can be us, we want it to be us. We don't want other players involved here. That's the way it seems like you're playing.
No, I don't think it's not like we want to be exclusionary. I think what we want is
no, but I mean not in terms of creativity. We don't want business.
No, yeah, we don't want bullshitters. I don't want the guys like we're dealing with now who are, you know, on boss level. Who are, frankly, I won't name them. It doesn't take a lot of work to, you know, who are scumbags,
right,
and who are not about, you know, the business of making great movies. They're about business of smash and grab and take as much money as you can. And, you know, they're kleptocrats, man. They want to flee the scene as quickly as possible. But here's the other thing. Here's the dual-edged sword. I don't know that the movie would have been made if we didn't have these particular scumbags. So it's one of those things where it's like, do you accept the fact that you got robbed blind in this one instance and that you've overextended yourself on a movie that now has to be pretty wildly successful to turn a, you know, to like...
I mean, when I remember you were doing an Instagram story and I wrote a message in there that blew me away because you said, it's a $40 million movie and we don't have distribution yet.
Yeah.
I was like, what?
Yeah. Shouldn't be.
Like, Mel Gibson and Frank Grillo, and it's like, how does that happen?
Naomi Watts. Because you get into situations with people where they know, you know, they very overtly play on your desire to make a movie because they know what it means to you. And they know what that process, and this is a script I've been trying to get made for 6 or 7 years. Chris and Eddie Borey, who wrote the original draft, wrote a hell of a screenplay and were gracious enough to let me come on and do my thing. But the bones of it are always, you know, have always been there. You know, it's like that... you know, Groundhog Day, you know, meets Die Hard, you know, and it was something I wanted to do. Something I wanted to do with Frank. We have screen tests going back 6 years that we did, you know, we shot to try to convince people that, you know, and Frank is now, they are. And Frank is now, I think, a far more mature, far more seasoned, far more precise
actor. He's one of those guys who I feel like, look, I mean, everyone kind of first saw him in, sort of first understood him in Winter Soldier.
Right.
Right? He had done some of his stuff. He had worked with a friend of mine, actually, when he did Prison Break, and he did the pilot of Breakout Kings.
Well, when he did Warrior, you remember, he was a coach in Warrior. He was amazing in that film. And then he did The Gray. And at the same time, he was getting
that
this...
That direct TV show.
Oh, yeah, Kingdom is amazing. Yeah, Kingdom. So here's a guy that's hitting his stride at a time when a lot of actors go, well, it's, you know, it's like they're starting to do the dad roles, you know. He's going the other way.
Right. He's starting at the I'm going to beat people up role.
He is, exactly. Which is very much in his, and you see him in Boss Level, you know, his actual son Rio plays his son in the movie. And the stuff between them is mind-blowingly great. You know, it's really touching and sweet, and you just get this extra gear. That, and I kept telling, and you know, Frank only tells me now, you know, he didn't want Rio to play that part. He had called Sharon Bialy, who's casting the movie, and said, I know Joe wants him and he believes in him, but I don't want to do this. I don't want to have Rio in the movie. I'm worried about him. And the kid winds up killing it. The kid winds up stealing the scenes with him and Frank. So, you know, it's like...
It sounds like at the end of the day, you made the best of the situation, but you had to deal with the scumbags to make the movie.
You had to.
But you also... Have you learned anything? Having now this... Like, now that you're in it and you're on kind of the other side, you're on that development side now.
I think, dude, as much as you
have
can...
Do you have an appreciation for development execs a little more now?
No, I don't. No. Not at all.
Okay, why?
I think here's the thing where development executives are concerned. The reason why I want to avoid studios and kind of studio space is that you've got all these development executives, all these creative executives running around with offices, with expense accounts. That incurs overhead. So somewhere that cost is going to come out, and where it's going to come out of is your movie. And unless you're doing
doing Avengers.
Or working for Disney. And by the way, we're all going to wind up working for Disney at this point. You know, you're beholden to a set of rules and regulations and a way of doing things that don't necessarily jibe with the way you want to do things, which is keep the cost down, spend the money smart, make something great, do it for a price, and get on with it. And I don't want to do, I'm not in the business of, nor do I want to be in the business of taking 2 years to make one movie. You know, I watched 2001 on IMAX last night at IMAX headquarters with Steve Weintraub from Collider, and it was amazing, dude. Amazing to see that film like that. Incredible. And you realize, man, that's 3.5 years of Kubrick's life, but that's his magnum opus in my mind, right? I don't want to do that, dude. I've got too many movies I want to do, and I don't want to shoot. If I can keep my schedules right around 40 days, that's the place I want to live.
Right. I mean, sounds like you took a lot of lessons when you did TV for a little bit.
Oh yeah, man. And also, listen, we did, if you can believe this, we did Boss Love in 27 days because these scumbags had taken so much money that we didn't have a choice. Like, we had to do it. And Mel kept saying to me, dude, if that movie comes out good, it's one of the most extraordinary directorial feats I've ever seen. This coming from Mel Gibson, dude. I'm going to have him say that into a tape recorder and just use it as my answering machine, you know, message. But the problem is, Meryl, you got some of these people exist to do is simply insert themselves between you and the money. If you can eliminate that and get to the money.
Right.
You know, I've got War Chest is our kind of fund up in Calgary, and it's all these oil and gas guys, all these great kind of,
you know what's funny?
Calgarians.
I got a friend who's in TV in Canada. And, you know, when that article came out about the funding that was going to be in Calgary, you know, he was like, oh, I wonder if it's like a bunch, there's a lot of oil money over there. I wonder if it's oil money.
It is.
So now I can tell him he was right.
It is. So these guys have been kind of our benefactors, and we've also proven to them.
I find funny is if you go back and listen to your Hollywood Trenches interview, which, by the way, everyone should go watch that. It's on YouTube.
I just watched it. It is. It's pretty funny.
Right. You say in that, I just want to find that one, like, rich dentist.
The dentist, yeah. Yeah.
And, like, come to the rap party, meet Will Smith, and then go away. Take all the credit. Like, and you basically found the rich dentist, mm-hmm. right? It's a rich oil guy, but it's the same concept.
Yeah, they're just in oil fields instead of drilling. They're drilling in fields instead of your mouth, so. but that's the... And also... You know, like on El Chicano, these guys finance.
Which is why we're here,
right?
Like, and we want to talk about that movie.
Yeah, yeah. Which is, you know, that's a $6.5-7 million movie that was financed completely privately
and shot here,
shot in L.A. and shot in Calgary.
Yeah,
majority of it shot in Calgary. So, you know, when you have those types of things, and you also have in Calgary, I love that town too. They could really make a run if they got their shit together, and they know where they should get their shit together.
They can make a run in Vancouver and Toronto.
They can make a run in Vancouver and Toronto, but they have to. What I would say to, and you know, listen, it's like about some of that, about some of the crew in that town. There's a laziness and there's an entitlement that Toronto does not have, and Vancouver does not have, and Montreal does not have. Where you got to get around, you got to get past yourself, man, and understand that if you really want to be a first-run city and bring people here, because they have a guy, Luke Azevedo, the film commissioner, who's a dynamite guy. and really smart, and has the Alberta media stage, they have these beautiful 20,000 square foot stages that they shot Fargo in, but these things are largely unoccupied. And I want to really, I want to shoot The Raid there is what I want to do. I want to go build there and really make a, because you also have a 17% on top of 30%.
So you won't be shooting The Raid on location in Venezuela?
Oh, no. No, we will not. We will not be going to Caracas, unfortunately.
Okay, but let's.
Can't do it.
Before we go to El Chicano, let's go one more. We got one more movie on the slate.
Yeah.
Directed by junk food cinema favorite Joe Lynch.
Yes.
Written by Adam Simon. He'll hear this, by the way. So say something. You can say something nice or terrible about Lynch.
Oh, no, I love Lynch.
I mean, Lynch posted a screen grab, some screen grab of Frank in a fight.
Oh,
and
yeah,
I'm like, when did Frank go Stallone? Like, because he looks like that's the most buffed out I've ever seen Frank.
Wait till you see him in Boss Level, dude. He's like 3% body fat. It's insane. You know, I lose weight just by being around Frank because you can't eat. You feel like a crook if you eat. You know, feel like you're stealing something. Oh, dude, Joe is. I always try to get Lynch to do this. I always tell him to do his Salma Hayek impersonation. He does the best Salma Hayek impersonation.
Because
he did Everly. Oh no, I'm sure he does, brother. I always get that. Lynch does an impression of me.
Yes.
Oh, I'm gonna kill him. I'm gonna make him do it when I see him in Cincinnati. But no, dude, Joe is one of those guys. I loved Everly. I loved Mayhem.
He shot that at 2.5. I mean,
I know,
how do you shoot Mayhem on 2.5?
And also, Joe, when you see, and he's working with Juan Mi, Asperos, our DP, I say our DP, but that's our guy, man. He shot Wheelman for us, El Chicano for us, Boss Level for us, and now Point Blank. This is our fourth movie with him. He's just a stud. And I knew he and Joe would hit it off like peanut butter and jelly, and they did. And now they're back. They did a couple shots, Meryl. There's two running camera shots that I'm like, I don't know how they did them. And they're all fired up. And I'm like, Frank Torres, the stunt coordinator, who's been my friend for 16 years. When I saw him, I was like, hey, Torres, where was this shit for Boss Level, bro? Where was these great cameras for, you know?
It's got to be something about Lynch, because even if you go all the way back to Knights of Badassdom,
yeah,
there's shots in Knights of Badassdom where you're like, this is expert level shooting.
Oh yeah, dude, Joe's a premier. He's a stud.
He must have some way with cinematographers that he needs to do classes on. Like, he should do a master class on how to talk to DPs.
Also, you got
to
remember, dude, Joe is also in addition to being a hyper literate film geek, he's also a very technically skilled lenses, you know, processes. Understanding glass, understanding, you know, everything, you know. And that's its own vesting.
So he knows how to speak in the language of a cinematographer and go, I need it this way with this lens. And
or just simply say, let's try this. Let's do that. You know, Juan Mi is just as astute, if not more so, than most directors he's going to work with. And he's always about trying things and experimenting. And you gotta remember, dude, he goes from I think Point Blank's an $11 million film,
El Chicano is a
$6.5 million film, and Boss Level's a $40 million film.
Right.
So, you know, he's all over the place. And he told us a great story. He said, all my friends in Spain said, you're an idiot for moving over there and doing all this. And then I just told him, I'm doing a movie with Joe Carnahan. So it's like, it wasn't all waste. I'm thinking, dude, if that's your claim to fame, let's up the imprimatur a little bit.
$11 million, I think, is Lynch's biggest budget ever.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just want to see, you see what he does with 2.5 on Mayhem.
Yeah.
What can he do with 11 when he's shooting
Joe's
in the States? Like,
oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, I'm so fascinated by that. So, mm-hmm. But El Chicano.
Yes.
Let's talk about this.
Yes.
Because I saw the trailer. Trailer's out.
Yeah.
I haven't got a chance to see the movie yet, but here's the thing. You shocked me twice now.
Yeah.
So I'm just in for the ride that anything that has Joe Carnahan's name attached
to it.
I'm
going to tell you something.
Because 4 years ago, you kept pushing me to see Stretch.
Right.
And I was scared.
Right.
Right? Because I was like, I just come out. I didn't know the town. I didn't understand the rules. So it's like, I didn't understand the concept of like, if a movie gets dropped, sometimes it's not the movie's fault. And so I finally, you hold the screening at CAA. I come out with Scott Mendelson from Forbes.
Yeah.
We watch it. I'm like, holy shit. Then
it's a great little movie, dude.
Yeah. And then you invite me out to see Wheelman 3 years later. Because Wheelman, last year.
Yeah.
And it was March of last year.
Yeah.
And I watched that and I'm like, okay, I'm in this weird situation. I hope I like it. And I watch it like, son of a bitch.
Yeah, dude.
Like, so now it's like at this point,
yeah,
you're two for two.
I'll tell you what's so I'm just on the El Chicano's better than both of them. It's like, it really is. No, it's like, I have never.
That's how it works, man.
I have never, no, but I've never in my career had such an unflagging, unfailing belief in a project as I do in El Chicano. And every time I hear, we don't really see the mark, we don't see this, I think to myself, this is why the studio system, this is why the, you know, this is why the creative executives that work within there, that by the way are entrenched and have been there way too long, they're like politicians.
Part of the problem is I honestly believe, because I have some, at least on the TV side, I have some friends that are execs, and what it's very clear is everyone's got a master out here. There is the, you know, the only ones that don't have masters are like Alan Horn and fucking, you know, that's it. Like, right. Alan Horn doesn't have a master.
Right.
He's the only one.
Right.
Or rather, no, even he has a master. Bob.
Iger.
Yeah. Iger has no master.
Right.
That's it. So.
Right.
It's like these execs, it might be that they do want to do that shit, but they have, the problem is they have to justify a failure.
Oh yeah,
right?
Dude.
They don't have
to justify saying no.
Right.
It's easy to say no, dude.
Like if they say yes and then it goes south, they have. So then, how do you justify it? Well, it's like, we had a star.
Meryl, here's the thing. This is the difference between. I mean, listen. There's a handful of guys, dude. You can literally count them on one hand. Who are like the studs, right? Lorenzo de Bonaventura, Mike DeLuca, Peter Chernin. Trying to think of the other. Who's another huge, former studio guy that became a baller in his own right. You start running out of names really quick because these guys, at the end of the day, dude, were still outliers, right? They still did Bill Mechanic. They still did, you know, stuff that was not, dude, Lorenzo famously almost got fired for spending $500,000 to secure the rights on a book series called Harry Potter. He almost lost his job at Warner Brothers. That's a true story. So,
and this is after The Matrix, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, dude.
Yeah, so
this is like Lorenzo spent $500,000 to get the rights to Harry Potter and almost got fired.
It's so easy to fire the execs. Like, that is part of the problem, I think.
Unless you're a guy like that who believes so thoroughly in himself, and that's why he and I are dear friends and close. Yeah, I think you have to have that firm belief in yourself, and guys like Lorenzo have that in spades, and they show that, and that's why he is such a successful producer in his own right. And that's why, I mean, he's a dear friend of mine, man. It's like, and he's somebody I go to counsel for, but I also think, and there are guys, there are iconoclasts. Tom Robbins is an iconoclast. He just happens to run a big studio, but these are the guys that ultimately have the ability to lean out, good or bad. You know, Tom famously passed on Deadpool, right? That's but when you've been doing it that long and you've greenlit hundreds of movies, there's going to be one or two that got your blind side.
But again, it goes back to the idea of I got to be honest. I get why you pass on Deadpool. I understood why. Like, you see the Amazon, like, how could you pass? And it's like, but it's not just about, like, it's not about the movie. It's about everything around the movie.
Right.
Like the second you say yes, you're shelling out millions just on development costs alone on that movie.
Yeah.
And it's going to have to be rated R. Everyone's going to get mad at you.
Yeah, yeah.
So then how do you have to make your money back on R-rated movie? And it's like, I understand why you say no. The only reason they said yes is because someone on the Deadpool team, it still remains a question of who, broke the rules and said, I'm putting out the test footage and let's watch what happens.
Oh, I think that was, yeah, but that test footage, I remember pimping that for Tim Miller way back on Twitter, or maybe prior to that, showing that footage, you know, that whole thing of him dropping into the car and beating up all those guys that they had done. Tim did all that, man. I mean, that was really, and I think understanding that was the way it was supposed to go. And also, listen, you know, Rob's comic was very much, that's the way Deadpool was written. You know, break the fourth wall, you know, be an asshole, be a smart. It's like, that's kind of custom made for Ryan Reynolds.
Right, and the question is, how do you market that? Obviously, they figured it out, but they had to be forced into figuring it out.
Because they didn't have a choice.
Right.
And that's why I think what's interesting with right now is what's kind of facing DC and Warner's. Like, how do you, you know, I'm looking forward to Aquaman because I love James Wan. I just am a big fan of James Wan.
So, Junkwood Cinema are big fans of James Wan as well.
Yes, so, you know, I'm looking forward to that. But I think what Patty, you know, I've known Patty forever. I love Patty to death. What she did with Wonder Woman was remarkable. You know, it's like, so, they've got the ability in Gal and in those kind to really make a run on things. But they got to decide. It's like, they either want to, listen, Feige and those guys have that Marvel, like, system on lock. No one's going to take that. Like, they do it better than anybody.
Well, also, I would submit what Feige did at the time was exactly what we're saying. I'm not here to knock Marvel at all. I think the problem is the Marvel imitators. Marvel, Feige believed in his product.
Yeah.
And it was something no one wanted to do.
Right.
So that's why I'd be like, it's the classic, you know, it's the Dark Knight. You know, you either die a hero, you live long enough to see yourself become the villain.
Right.
So now everyone hates Marvel because they're like, well, everyone wants to do Marvel. I was like, yeah, because it worked.
Right. And they, listen, but I think where DC's concerned, you got to remember, Iron Man and the Dark Knight come out the same year. You could have said very easily that DC possessed a huge head start in terms of, you know what I mean? And I know that, you know, the George Miller Justice League, which goddamn, I would have loved to have seen that version, man.
I would love to see it now. I don't think I would have wanted to see it then, because then it would have been a really weird movie.
Well, I think, you know, I think the idea was, I think what Feige and Marvel did really brilliantly was, let's do individual characters, them, and then put them into a super team. Because now, rather than start with the super team and then split them off, because it's impossible to get to know everybody in a super movie, right?
Right.
But if you have an idea of who they are.
That's you know, Cargill was talking about this on Twitter recently. If you watch Infinity War, it breaks all the rules of narrative storytelling.
Right.
It doesn't have a protagonist.
No.
It doesn't really have a 1-2-3 structure.
Thanos is really the protagonist.
And he's
weird.
But he's kind of not. Like,
you kind of dig in his defense. It's like, it's the same way. It's like, I loved Michael B. Jordan in Black Panther, because that one part where he says, you know, there's 2 billion people in the world that look like you and me, and you're going to keep this from him. Right there, you go, wait, is he a bad guy?
Right.
Because that's really sound reasoning.
Yeah.
And for an antagonist, like, logical, like, that's what they did. And I think that was the coup of that movie. Black Panther, for me, was just the reasoning behind, you know, the quote unquote bad guy.
I'll tell you the moment where I was sitting Black Panther and went, oh, you know what, this movie is gonna, I get it now. Was I'm sitting in the theater, I'm in Burbank, and there's the moment where I can't remember anyone's names, the warrior girl,
the girl that's the girl that's
with the shaved head.
Yes,
she's in a relationship with the dude from Get Out.
Yes,
and the dude from Get Out's riding this big
rhino
thing, and then it stops and licks her face.
Yes,
and I watched this woman in front of me put her arm up, start snapping her fingers, and go, "Mm-hmm, girl." And I'm like, "Oh God, you know
that's
what? I get
hysterical.
It now. I get it now.
That's
I
hysterical.
Get it.
Yeah.
Like, I get why this movie's about to be huge.
Right, right.
And I totally and I understood, like, because for me, I'm like, I've seen that before, but I realized, oh, you know what? You lady have never seen that in a $200 million movie before.
No.
I understood that moment. Why?
No. And, like, and I think to your point, it's like, it's the what that movie did brilliantly was, you know, give an audience what they want in the way they least expect it.
Yeah.
Which is what I think we did with El Chicano. Like,
so El Chicano is, run it down for us.
It's basically this. It is, you know, the movie was originally going to open in 1943 at the Zoot Suit Riots, and then move through time, like 1958, the Chavez Ravine evictions, 1970, the Chicano Moratorium, in the 80s with the crack epidemic, and you're going to see, in a Zelig, Forrest Gump-like way, El Chicano moving through these various eras. And his mask would always be different. And it was really cool the way we had it. And, of course, we get the budget. We're like, well, that's all gone. We're going to start this in the 90s. What it's about, essentially, is these twin brothers, Diego and Pedro Hernandez, who grow up in East L.A. And they again, it's the classic, you know, Dick and Senny in very different paths. One's a cop, one becomes a gangster. And they haven't spoken. And at a murder scene, Diego realizes all these guys, these dead vatos, are inked with his brother's nickname and their shared birthday. And it sends him down this rabbit hole of, like, he hadn't spoken to his brother in years and just thought, my brother's a thug. And what he realizes is his brother was in a way to reform and atone for what he had done with his life. He was essentially resurrecting this Batman like figure from his youth, El Chicano, the ghetto Grim Reaper, this guy that kind of, you know, who would tag neighborhoods in the stop sign. If you saw that tag, it meant somebody on the block was marked, and so that's the kind of point of departure for the movie. And if you see it, it's like, I think people go in there and they, especially in a theater, man, and they go in there and they think they're going to see this kind of, oh, it's a, like a low budget. And then it plays like Batman, dude. There's a
shot in the trailer. It's El Chicano in the rain fighting a dude.
Yeah.
And it's like, what the fuck?
It looks like Blade Runner.
Yeah,
I know.
It's
Juan Mi.
Because
you know?
it's the moment where you go, oh, this is where all the money went.
Oh yeah,
this is where all the money went.
And you know, you've got, you know, Raul Castillo, who's coming off this really, you know, We the Animals. He's coming off this really kind of hot independent film. George Lopez, who I don't think people are prepared for how good a dramatic actor he is, unless you've seen Ken Loach's Bread and Roses years and years and years ago, you realize how good George can be. But, like, you know, I mean, dude, Jose Pablo Cantillo is amazing. David Castaneda, Armida Lopez, Amy Garcia. Like, you've got these really great performances in this movie. Sal Lopez, Marco Rodriguez. I mean, when I went, we screened at LATC, Latin Theater Company, about 3 weeks ago, maybe a month ago. And Marco, who's like the bad guy, you recognize him. He's like, he was in Eastbound and Down. He played like the baseball. He played the manager Danny McBride's team, like Mexican, you know. And he was like the bad guy in Cobra in the grocery store when he was like a kid. And he's a great character.
Is he the guy in the cop car? Is he the guy in, because there's a guy in a.
No, that's Noel G.
No, is he the guy in the wheelchair?
No, that's Emilio. That's Emilio Rivera.
The guy I'm thinking of, you have in the movie, you have the guy from Sons of Anarchy who's now in.
Yes,
fucking,
Emilio.
Emilio,
who, by the way, blew his leg out riding a motorcycle and we had to put him in a wheelchair. So we had to write that in. But, you know, Marco plays kind of the Yoda character, for lack of a better, kind of the guy that knows what's going on, kind of this old veterano who lives in the neighborhood, but he's the keeper of secrets, right? And he's so good in the movie. And I went up to him afterwards.
This movie sounds so layered.
Dude, I walked up to him afterwards. He was shaking. He said, Joe, I've been doing this for 42 years. I've never been in anything like this. I've never been part of anything like this.
This is what I'm saying. Like, every time you've got a movie coming now, I'm like, I don't know if this is going to be the one, Joe. I don't think this is going to work.
Well,
and then
tell you
see
what,
it,
dude,
and you're like, what the
brother,
fuck?
I'll tell you what. This movie, and also, you got to remember, 24, almost 25% of the tickets bought in this country are bought by Hispanic, Latino. Like, we don't program for them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. So the other part of me, I mean, listen, man, I left Bad Boys 3 ostensibly to go and work on this movie. That's how much I believed in it. That I wanted to... You know,
you left basically a job where Sony was like, "Here, we're going to give you a lot of money to not do anything for like 6 months."
Yeah, yeah, or a year. And I just thought to myself, you know, and listen, I'm glad it went down the way it went down. I'm glad that, you know, Will and I ultimately didn't see eye to eye, and it happens. And I left, and you know, and by the way, they're no closer to making that movie, so it wasn't like I'm, you know what I mean? It, to my mind, it wasn't like something that I regret or I have any misgivings about now. I thought like that was the time to go. And to be able to have given all my energy, and by the way, to the point where I'm probably 40 grand into this movie, I haven't made any money on this film, but that's how much I believe on it, you know, in it, that I'm so thoroughly, I know what it is, I know what it can be, and I know what we're about to do with it, and it's exciting to me. You know, it's exciting that we're going to get it out there in a really big way.
I mean, you don't have distribution yet on it, right? It's just playing the circuit.
No, I think we're going to take this out on our own. I think we're going to go out on our own with this film.
We're
going to do the Soderbergh, like Bleecker Street kind of formula and go like, and I can't tell you who's about to work with us, but there's a company run by a dear friend of mine who's had tremendous success at two separate studios and won Best Picture Oscars for both those studios. That I think we're going to do something with. And he's equally...
Do you mean you're
going
to tour it?
We're basically going to go. The plan is to go out and get our own P&A and open this film through his new company and kind of that's our plan.
Baller.
Right now.
That's some baller.
I'm
shit,
telling
dude.
You, brother. It's like, listen, the minute I can do that, I will be able to dispel all this horseshit that's been so closely held.
Can I do
in this
it on
business.
$5 million? Yeah. Then I don't need you people.
Why do I need you? Why do I need a creative executive? As you say, dude. You have to explain a failure, but why do I need a creative executive to sit there and have to justify not only that, but his office, his assistant,
and then
his expense account,
and then anything that you need a little more money on? Hey Netflix, what you doing? You busy? Can we talk?
By the way, they just write checks, man. You know, like I'm point blank. I never have to worry about money on that movie. It's like it's boom, it's there, it's there.
Well, there is always a fear on that. Like when you know there is a like the idea of where you know Netflix. I think has been very like. People like there were. I remember when all those articles got written about like the debt they're carrying. I'm like, have you ever? Do you know how a business works? That's how a business works. They carry debt.
Yeah,
that's how anything.
Dude, massive amounts of debt.
That's like when everyone was like, they have $900 billion in debt. I was like, yeah.
Yeah,
also because they're a global company. They're right. Not like Apple carries that much debt. I'm
sure they
sure.
do. Sure they do.
Like that's just how it goes down.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I wasn't at all concerned about that. So I think Netflix has actually been fairly transparent where their money comes in.
And they've also been, I think, kind of wonderfully so. Like, they, as you say, they don't, these are not meddlesome people. These are not, they get into business with people they can trust.
They understand it's like, I don't know how to do this.
And they also have great taste and great, and by the way, from the doc side, you know, to the feature side, you know, Brandon and Sean, the guys who work with on Fight World, were remarkable, smart guys, opinionated guys, but not assholes. Not never like driving anything down our throats. Never like never giving you mandates.
If you want, but here's what we're feeling.
Yeah, like, yeah,
yeah.
Not this is an edict and you must follow it. You know, it was like, here's what we think. If it works for you, great. If not, then you know, carry on.
I mean, I think you got everyone excited for this movie. So right now, you know, well, before we move on to a few more things, but it's like, quickly, you're premiering this fucker in L.A.
September 22nd. Los Angeles Film Festival.
You still buy tickets.
Yep.
I believe.
I think it's getting close to being sold out. Yeah.
Do you think you'll have another screening?
I don't know, brother.
And
I
then
don't know.
You're taking it to...
And then we have a date, which I won't discuss right now because we're still trying to put this stuff together.
But you're taking it to Napa.
Then we're gonna go now. But that's gonna be in it. That's gonna be, that'll literally be closer to the what we think the release is gonna be.
Okay. Is it coming out this year? Is that the hope?
I hope so.
Okay.
I hope so. It'd be great to get it out or first quarter next year.
Okay.
It just depends on.
So keep an eye on El Chicano, people. If you're in the LA area, get your asses over to the LA Film Festival. Watch the world premiere with.
Yep.
I assume you're gonna be there.
I will be there.
Ben will be there.
I'll be there.
Yeah. So okay. So
Ben will be there dressed as mariachis. It's gonna be amazing. Not a musical bone between us.
War Party, where are you going with it now? Like, you got the raid coming up.
Yeah. Well, what we want to do is, listen, I want to stick in these kind of identifiable genre films and elevate the elevated genre. I think that's what we do really well. We're never going to do the coming of age road movie,
between
dying grandmother
and her budget action.
Yeah. Yeah,
if you can find it, do it cheap. Maybe some genre, sci-fi, fantasy, whatever.
Yes,
but keep it like that hard-edged.
Yep, correct.
Like, thing.
Correct. It very much so, and I think that is where kind of we want to live, and that's what to me is the most consistently profitable stuff. And if you're making it, you know, Wheel Man was a big hit for Netflix, you know, and so it was
bigger hit than Bright.
Who knows? I'm sure Bright got a lot more eyes, but you know, it's. That's where we want to stay, and that's where we want to remain. And also, I think, listen, I think Wheelman's a better film, so it's more entertaining. So for whatever the money, it doesn't really matter, like, because if one's better than the other one, it becomes very clear.
I mean, like I was telling you, it just, for whatever reason, Bright doesn't play as well in that format,
right?
Than right. Wheelman does,
right?
Right?
Yeah, you probably would have wanted to see Bright on a big screen.
Well, but I saw Bright on a big screen. Even on a big screen, it felt a little wonky.
Right.
But I also heard that, like, Netflix didn't master what I saw in the theater for the press screening.
Oh.
They didn't master it for theater.
Right.
They didn't master for the like. They just mastered for TV and showed us what was mastered for TV, and it looked really dark and kind of hard to watch.
Right.
But so that might just have been a problem with what I was watching.
Sure.
But Wheelman, like. That shit was geared for everything. Like,
oh, dude! And by the way, you saw it in a theater. That thing's a rocket slide.
Yeah, and Brian and Cargo got to see it in Fantastic Fest too. I was like,
right.
Oh, I wish I could have seen.
No,
that with the
Robert
audience.
And I, we hung out all night that night after that. And
by the way,
him.
Yeah, I heard about.
He's
that.
Such. I'm very like I love him because he's also a novelist. So I'm extra jealous that he can write like that.
When do you write the novel, Joe? Get on that.
I'd have to sit with Cargo, and he'd have to give me a bunch of advice. That's a discipline.
Both just follow his Twitter. That's literally what he does.
Exactly. That's a discipline that I don't think that I haven't quite wrapped my head around. As much as I love to write, that is a holding up for and I think of the guys I really love, you know, Franzen and David Foster Wallace. I mean, these guys are like legit novelists. And I was even reading Frank Bill, who wrote Donnybrook, but I'm reading his book The Savage, and I'm like, God, this guy can write, man. You know, it's just like, I think my brother will wind up writing a novel. My brother's a hell of a writer. Much better writer than me. And I think his predilections lean toward more of a novel. I think he likes that man of letters thing too. You know, he wants to be a novelist. And I think he'll probably beat me to the punch, but I would love to. If I could find a story I was really, really into, I would do it.
Junkians, you heard it here first. Just go and pester Joe on Twitter. And in between.
Oh, yeah, that works.
And
Meryl.
In between.
That works.
Yeah, and in between, just, you know, throw some pro gun shit at him and he'll make sure to answer you.
Pro gun, pro Trump. you know.
And he'll be
anti-choice.
He'll
yeah,
he'll come, answer you, and they get banned on
yeah,
Twitter.
Come, yeah, come, yeah, exactly. By the way, I'm not. I hope fucking Corey Lewandowski gets hit by a double decker bus. That's what I got banned for. I said, I hope this cunt gets hit by a double decker bus. Unless you're in, you know, Piccadilly, you know, square. Like, I mean, come on, where are you going to get hit by a double decker bus? Right. It's impossible. Right. You know, so
Joe. You know, we're all excited for El Chicano. We're all excited for Boss Level. We're all excited for War Party. We're all excited for Point Blank.
Yeah.
You know, War Party's killing it.
We are indeed.
Thank you for sitting down with us.
You got it, Meryl. Anytime.
Yep. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that'll do for this episode. A chat with Joe Carnahan. You know where to go. Patreon.com/JunkFoodCinema. Sign up for just $1 an episode, and you get all sorts of content. It's a good time. That'll do it. Talk to you guys later.